Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we invite you to consider the collapse of Western civilization. It's the title of, I guess you could call it a long essay that has just been published, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. And the authors blend two genres, science fiction writers who imagine an imaginary future, and historians who attempt to reconstruct the past. So imagine a future historian looking back on a past that is our present and possible future. The occasion is the tercentenary of the end of Western culture, and the dilemma being addressed is how we, the children of the Enlightenment, failed to act on all this information about climate change and knowledge of the damaging events that were about to unfold. The historian concludes that a second dark age had fallen on Western civilization in which denial and self-deception, rooted in an ideological fixation on free markets, disabled the world's powerful nations in the face of tragedy. Our guests are Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Her essay in 2004, The Scientific Consensus on Climate Change, was cited by Al Gore in An Inconvenient Truth. Eric Conway is joining us as well, a historian of science and technology employed by the California Institute of Technology. He recently received a NASA History Award for pathbreaking contributions to space history, ranging from aeronautics to earth and space sciences. And they also are the author of another book, which was pretty highly acclaimed, which we will talk about this hour as well. It's how certain forces were able to put a cloud over tobacco smoke and global warming. The book was titled Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. Naomi, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, a pleasure to have you here. And Eric, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Well, what an interesting idea to sort of combine these two genres of science fiction and history. It makes for a pretty powerful book, don't you think?
Well, that was sort of the idea. Eric and I had plowed through an awful lot of scientific material in the course of writing Merchants of Doubt, and we were just trying to find a more powerful way to tell the story, a more powerful way to tell the story of what's at stake and what could potentially happen if we continue business as usual.
Mm-hmm. And the book, Eric, recounts events of 1988 to 2093 that you say led to the great collapse and to mass migration.
Yes, indeed. We did it that way so that the events from 88 to the present, here in 2014, are all drawn from things that have already happened. So they're all true. And then, of course, we then made them, or took our ideas forward into the future in order to create an account of what may come if we continue to do nothing about climate change.
You talk about the fact that 100 years before it fall, if it falls, 100 years before this fall, the Western world knew that carbon dioxide and water vapor absorbed heat in the planetary atmosphere. For 100 years before its fall, that's a long period of time to not think, well, we better do something about this, isn't it, Naomi?
Exactly. And Eric and I are both historians of science, and we first came to this issue from the work that we had been doing in the history of earth science, history of oceanography, and history of meteorology. And one of the things that we had come to understand about this subject was how really old the science was, how well established it was, and how really uncontroversial it is in the scientific community.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that realization that led me to write my 2004 paper on the scientific consensus on climate change, for which I was brutally attacked by all kinds of people who are in denial about climate change. And that was it was that experience of being attacked that then led us to write Merchants of Doubt, to try to understand, well, what the heck is going on here? Why are people denying science that is very well established and is really quite uncontroversial scientifically, and yet it's become tremendously controversial economically, politically, socially? What is that really about?
It sure has become controversial. How were you attacked, Naomi?
Oh, I got hate email. People wrote letters trying to ask my university to fire me.
Ooh.
I was, internet mailings were sent around accusing me of being fraudulent, being Stalinist. And then the kind of crescendo was when Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma made a speech on the floor of Congress, on the floor of the Senate, in which he attacked me by name and said that I was part of the global conspiracy to bring down, the liberal conspiracy to bring down global capitalism. And, of course, my response to that was, well, liberals should be so organized.
That's pretty funny. What, at some point, you look at, and I found this to be true doing a lot of shows on climate change. I frequently will interview people who are really at the top of their profession and know about what's happening to oceans or know about what's happening to the sky or can give us an idea of what might happen to land masses down the road. But to almost a person, they always preface their comments by saying, I can't speak to anything other than, and then they proceed to talk about what their special area of interest is. Is this part of the problem here, that everybody's not taking on the whole? They're so trained into specialties that they can't sound an alarm about everything?
Well, right, and this is one of the things that our future historian concludes, that the whole structure of the scientific community, the structure of expertise as it exists in our current world, is very, very subdivided. But climate change is a complicated, interrelated problem in which the oceans, the atmosphere, our economic systems, our way of life, these things are all interconnected. And so to really understand climate change, both in terms of what's happening and also in terms of why it matters, that requires stepping back from the details and really trying to look at the big picture. And the scientific community has really been hamstrung, I think Eric and I both think, in large part because of their expertise. So paradoxically, the people who best understand the details are also really not good at telling the whole story and explaining why it matters. And so the book was really an attempt to try to do that, to step back and to look at the whole picture and say, here's how these different pieces are interrelated, and here's why it really, really matters.
Mm-hmm. I've always thought that maybe we need scientists who are also good politicians, because it would be pretty hard to argue with a woman or a man who was a scientist who knew his stuff on this and who had a national platform.
Yeah.
Well, a good communicator, I would say.
Right.
I don't know that I really want scientists
right.
to become politicians.
You're right. Okay.
But a good communicator who really understands how to reach a public audience, because I have similar experiences with Naomi. I work with ocean scientists around in my day job all the time, and a lot of them don't even realize that we measure things like solar irradiance, the amount of sunlight that reaches the world every day, and can explain that to a public audience. And that's frustrating as a communicator.
Right. So as the historian, tell us what happened. Give us a brief history, starting, if you would. Well, you can start with the Industrial Revolution if you want to. Go. How far do we go back in order to get a historical understanding of where we might be in 2093?
Well, the Industrial Revolution is a good place to start, because that's when people first began to tap into the energy in fossil fuels. And that's obviously important on many levels, but perhaps the most important level is that most people experienced the Industrial Revolution as a good thing. The quality of life for many people became much better, and nobody realized at that time that there was this sort of Achilles heel of fossil fuels, which was the greenhouse gas problem. So the people involved in the Industrial Revolution could be forgiven because they didn't know. But now we fast forward, to the 20th century, to the 1950s, when scientists begin to say, well, hold on a minute. Burning fossil fuels produces carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. These warm the climate, and if that continues unabated, we can expect sea level to rise. We can expect impacts on crops and agriculture. We can expect all kinds of impacts that would affect people and even the political stability of countries. This is something that scientists already were talking about in the 1960s and 70s. And yet, what we saw, what Eric and I chronicled, Emergence of Doubt, was that as soon as scientists began to speak up clearly about not just the fact of climate change, but its implications, a denial campaign arose in response to try to challenge that scientific evidence, to claim that we didn't really know, we weren't really certain, and therefore it would be premature to act. So the premise of the new book is to say, well, it's no longer premature. It's actually rather late. We are getting very close to the 11th hour here, and if we don't do something soon, this is what it may very well look like. The book is a story. It's deliberately dramatic, but everything in it is based on either, as Eric just said, things that actually have already happened, things that are starting to happen, like the destabilization of the West Antarctic ice sheet, or things that scientific models and forecasts show are well within the realm of plausibility.
Mm-hmm. You talk about historians, Eric, viewing 1988 as the start of the penumbral period. What is that period?
The penumbral period really is a period in which the shadow of denial really starts to grow over the climate issue. Of course, it's also the year in which we start getting major scientists speaking publicly about the need to act on climate change, 88, 89, in the United States and in congressional testimony and so on. And so that shadow of doubt then grows from then on because of these denial campaigns. That's the idea there is to get across the intellectual idea that that the denial campaign is successful in confusing the state of public knowledge so much that we continue to not do anything about climate change.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you make the point here, the number of I think it's that the wealthiest businesses the world has ever known are part of the carbon combustion complex. So people are making a whole lot of money off this and probably are more than a wee bit threatened, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, indeed. Of course. Naomi, you were going to say something, I think.
Oh, I was just going to add the other thing about the penumbral period is that historians are always trying to divide history into periods. It's part of how we manage the complexity of history.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were writing this book, we started thinking about, well, what will historians call this period, right? I mean, we had the Dark Ages, we had the Enlightenment. So playing with that notion of light and darkness, I don't think anybody wants to say we're back to a second Dark Ages, but this idea that a shadow was falling, a shadow of denial that was standing in the way, blocking the light of knowledge, that was sort of the motif of the metaphor that we were trying to introduce.
Mm-hmm. What do you say, what does the historian have to say about who has the power during this period of decline? Is it at all in the hands of people who understand the climate system?
No, exactly. So the historian concludes that this is part of the crux of the issue, that you have these people, scientific experts, who understand very, very well what is going on, and they try to communicate it, and they go to actually fairly great lengths to try to explain it, but they don't actually have power. So we've all heard that phrase, knowledge is power, but actually it's not true. Scientists have tremendous amounts of knowledge about the climate system, and they actually are almost powerless to do anything about it. So where does power really reside? Well, as you just mentioned, our future historian comes up with this phrase, the carbon combustion complex, to talk about this complicated network that involves the fossil fuel industry, but it's not only the fossil fuel industry. It's also all the industries that depend on inexpensive fossil fuels, which includes automobiles, aviation, smelting of aluminum, and all of the think tanks that support those fossil fuel companies or are paid for by them, as well as marketing, advertisement, public relations, this whole nexus of interrelated organizations and activities that support the status quo, support an economy that is based upon cheap, easily available fossil fuels.
And even, you say, the financial institutions that service their capital demands.
Yes, and the financial institutions, that's right.
Yeah. Are there certain countries, I was listening to the radio yesterday, I think, and just heard part of a report, I think it was on Marketplace, where somebody from China was talking about the incredible smog and he couldn't ride his bike to work on certain days, but the Chinese government had been fairly good about closing down industries when things got particularly bad because some were realizing that they were going to have to change simply because you can't have a company or a country operate where people can't go outside or, you know, airplanes can't land because they can't see where they're going. He made an interesting point, and you look at this philosophy as well in the book, that maybe the country that could do something about this would be a country like China because it's authoritarian and they can just tell people, this is what we're going to do. We're not going to have debate about it. We know this is what is happening, and by golly, we're going to change it. Did that make any sense to you?
Eric, do you want to take that one?
Do I want to take that one? Sure. We chose China because one of the great fears of our actors in From Merchants of Doubt was precisely this fear that government would become totalitarian if we took these measures to rein in greenhouse gas production and fossil fuel usage and so on. And their real fear wasn't that their fear was more, therefore, of big government than it was of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And so we picked China as kind of the epitome of the one surviving supposedly communist big authoritarian government, and use them as kind of a foil for the story to show that, well, yes, they could survive this, and yes, they could manage the fossil fuel problem in a way that we couldn't, but also in ways that certainly nobody who likes political freedom would actually think is a good idea. So our point, our larger point in doing that was to simply present that their fear comes true, but not for us. That because we lock ourselves into this sort of political denial that we're in now, the worst comes to pass and their fear comes to pass, and we simply go into long civilization decline because we couldn't react within the bounds of our democratic system.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and here is how you reach us. We're speaking with the authors of the book, which is really a long essay, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And it looks at, you know, we've thought of this before, but we've never taken it as far as talking with the authors of a book because there aren't too many books that have been written like this. It's what may happen if indeed we don't pay attention to the warning signs that are with us right now concerning climate change. And our guests are heavily credentialed. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. She wrote a 2004 essay, The Scientific Consensus on Climate Change, that was cited by Al Gore in An Inconvenient Truth. Eric Conway is also with us, historian of science and technology employed by the California Institute of Technology. The two are also authors of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. Phone calls, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, feel free to leave your comments there. We'd like to read them, and you'll like to read them as well, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for our guests, and we will start with Carol in Milwaukee. Hi, Carol. Hello, Carol. Are you there?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead,
Hello.
Carol. Go ahead, Carol.
That's me?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm just calling to say thank you, and I commend them for what they're doing, but unfortunately, I don't think we have the political will, and I don't think we have the will as a humanity, and I will give an example of that. California is under a water ban, and since they imposed the water ban, people are actually using more water.
Naomi, you want to respond?
Well, I think there has been a lack of political will up till now in many cases. That's certainly true, and I think that's in a way why Eric and I wrote this book, that we really want to help people to sort of really process on an emotional level what this potentially means and to use that to try to help generate political will. But at the same time, you know, Eric and I, well, I recently moved away from California, but I still consider California home. Eric lives in Pasadena. I mean, California has been one of the places in the states where there's actually tremendous political will, and with AB 32, the Emissions Control Act, California is actually probably doing more than any other state in the country to act on climate change. So I think there is political will. It's not mostly inside the Beltway right now, but we are seeing political will in a lot of places around the country. So I think when you shift your gaze away from Washington, D.C., there's a lot of actually promising signs, but the question is how do we mobilize that and make it scale it up to the level on which we really need action on this issue.
Mm. Eric, you want to respond to that?
I agree with Naomi. Part of our purpose in writing is that we're trying to reach new audiences and to help create some of the political will. And I also agree that there's, in a lot of ways, there's more action going on at the state level, not just here, than there is in Washington right now. But to respond to the specific California question, they imposed voluntary restrictions, which have been largely an utter failure in the state, as the caller suggests, and they're just finally getting around to making it mandatory. But another thing the state has not done, and I think that has actually been better done across the border in Nevada, is the state has not yet really put into place really strong incentives, such as financial assistance for replacing lawns and so forth with low water consumption, landscaping, and so forth, that have been used successfully at the town and city level in California, but not yet at the state. And that's the kind of incentive that can actually make a lot of difference. And you can imagine climate incentives working in similar sorts of ways.
Eric, you said you wanted to reach new audiences. Who are the new audiences?
Well, Merchants of Doubt was aimed at historians, and unfortunately for our sales, probably it was shelved largely in the science section, and the audience for science books in the U.S. is pretty darn small. And so we were hoping by writing this in a futurist way, we could reach a more literary audience than the kind of the back of the bookstore science shelf got us before.
Mm-hmm. But also by telling a compelling story, by writing something that was fun to read. I mean, Merchants of Doubt, you know, has done quite well, and I think we're both proud of it, and we think that for a serious nonfiction book, it's pretty darn readable, but it's still a serious nonfiction book. So we tried to write something here that was a little shorter, a little more compelling, you know, a little maybe more fun, and not quite such a heavy lift.
Except you're talking about the end of Western civilization, which isn't
fun.
Well,
that's true, and some people have said it was depressing, especially the part where the cats and dogs all die.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, it's meant to be kind of an engaging story.
Which it is, no doubt about that. Yeah. Thanks, Carol. John and Dunn, hi.
Hi. I think, you know, the warnings are great. You think back to General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower warning about the industrial military complex, and people have been... we still have that, you know. We still don't. I mean, although people talked about it, it's still there. And I give you guys credit for trying to do something about it, about the what's happening, the warming. But maybe going along with that, since legislation is probably not going to happen for a long time, maybe we should try to amend the Constitution.
How so?
Well. Yeah, that's for people who know more about it than I do. Maybe it's too complex to amend the Constitution, but it seems like the people need to take it into their own hands if the legislature and the, doesn't seem to be concerned enough about it to do. They can't. The pressure that they get from this huge complex of energy producers and sellers is they can't butt that.
Yeah. Eric, who needs to act and would make a difference if they did act?
Oh, my. In the United States, because of the complexity of our federal system, actions can and have to be taken at a variety of different levels. Individual action is necessary but not sufficient, right, because I can't change the fossil fuel infrastructure of Los Angeles on my own. I can, on the other hand, lobby the city to install better mass transit, which it's been doing, fortunately. I can work at the state level to get the state to invest more heavily in renewable energy. And in California, of course, it has been. That's, again, a necessary but insufficient level. And at the some level, in order to get all the way towards the at least 80% reduction of carbon emissions goals that we have to meet to stave off the worst effects of climate change, we will also need some amount of federal action. But we're seeing EPA action now, probably not the most efficient, but it's something. But it's not enough that individual action happens. We need action at every level of the federalist system that we have in the United States in order to make it work.
Yeah, I think Eric hit the nail on the head earlier when he talked about the incentives. Right now we have many perverse incentives that continue to encourage consumption of fossil fuels, even waste of fossil fuels. The World Bank estimates that global subsidies to the fossil fuel industry are $700 billion every year. I mean, that's completely crazy, right? The fossil fuel industry doesn't need to be subsidized. It needs to be phased out. So one of the first steps we could do is to work towards the elimination of subsidies to the fossil fuel industry to make the market a more level playing field. And then a second thing we could do is to create a positive incentive away from fossil fuels. And lots of people have been talking about what a carbon tax could be due. And, of course, Americans in general don't like carbon, don't like taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But actually a lot of Republican leaders and conservative economists have endorsed the idea of a carbon tax because it's a very efficient market-based mechanism to create a positive incentive to move to renewables and other low-carbon fuels. And that could be done on the federal level. It would be most efficiently done on the federal level. In fact, former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson has recently been talking about this. But it could also be done on state and regional levels as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's something that actually could be implemented rather quickly, and it could also be done in a revenue-neutral way, where you increase the carbon, you create a carbon tax, but you decrease income or other taxes to make up for it so that we're not increasing the total tax burden on the American people. We're just shifting it in a way that's more productive.
Right. In other words, to tax what you don't want people to do and not tax what you do want them to do, which is to make money.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Tell us before we go back to phone calls, our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. There are some interesting maps in the collapse of Western civilization. The historian is looking in 2093 at a planet where, take it where you want, but there's a map of the form of Florida. There's a map that we wouldn't recognize now of what New York may be. Whoever wants to take this.
Yeah, well, we included the maps partly because we wanted to have illustrations, because most good stories have illustrations, but also because we were trying to bring across the point that we're all at risk. A lot of people still have the impression that climate change is something that will mostly affect people far away or in the future, so people who live in Bangladesh or something like that. And a lot of people, I think, haven't really thought about how many American cities, how many major European capitals sit at sea level and are vulnerable to even relatively modest levels of sea level rise that scientists tell us are almost certain to happen, say, by 2100, and could be completely inundated if some of the higher case scenarios come to pass. So we drew these maps to point out that the configuration of the world is potentially changed in ways that would dislocate hundreds of millions of people and would drown many of the major cities of the world. So the world of a future, if we continue business as usual, does not look like the world of today.
Let's welcome more phone calls, and we go next to Mark in Brookfield. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think one of the problems is science really needs a helping hand in connecting the dots in explaining how many jobs and how much wealth can be generated by turning away from fossil fuels and embracing all these alternatives and renewables that, in a lot of senses, have been technologies around for a long time that have been just kicked under the rug in favor of fossil fuels. And I'm just thinking that once everybody realizes how many jobs and how much money can be made from the renewable end, they'll gladly turn to it, but they're turned off by cap and trade and cap and tax and all that other stuff. You know, so you got to kind of put it in a more positive light.
Mm-hmm. Eric, let's throw this one your way. Whoops, hello.
I'm here.
Oh, we can barely hear you, Eric. Something happened to our phone thing. Hello? Yeah, let's try and figure this out. We'll take a pause and return and continue with our guests who are the authors of The Collapse of Western Civilization. We'll keep your thought in mind, Mark, and it's a good one. And we'll ask both of our guests to respond. The authors are Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway. And Eric, let me just tell you a little bit about both of them if you're just tuning us in, is a historian of science and technology employed by the California Institute of Technology. Also joining us is Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. They are also author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to Eric, who is going to respond to our last caller. Hi, Eric. No, I still can't hear you at all.
Do you want me to take this one?
Yeah, would you please, Naomi? Something's happened with our phone connection with him. Go ahead.
Weird.
Hello?
You still can't hear me either?
I am hearing everybody. No, I can hear you.
Okay. There's definitely money to be made in renewables, and the solar industry is actually exceeding expectations right now. And many people across the United States and elsewhere are installing solar in their homes. Many businesses are. So there's a real positive success story there. But it's also important for us to understand that the renewable industry is also up against a disinformation campaign. So we know, for example, that there have been advertising campaigns misrepresenting some of the alleged benefits of gas, for example, misrepresenting some of the environmental hazards of wind. Mm-hmm. We know that there's been funding of attempts to discredit wind power based on allegations that they kill many birds, those allegations are largely false or at least exaggerated. So, yes, I think that people do see the opportunity to make money in renewables, and that's a great thing, and we're seeing a lot of growth in the renewable market now. But we're also seeing renewables being undercut by disinformation and also by the impacts of cheap gas, you know, which has flooded the market in the last couple of years and made it more difficult for wind and solar to compete in some domains.
Mm-hmm. Eric, would you like to respond?
I was going to say essentially what Naomi just did, that it's not so much that scientists aren't connecting the dots, but their voices are being drowned out by the economic disinformation campaign that our economy can't function unless it's got cheap fossil fuels, and that's just not so.
All right, let's go next to Joe in Star Lake. Hi, Joe.
Hi, I'm glad to be on the show.
Thanks.
And the reason I'm calling is I do a fair amount of speaking. We live in Washington State, but we come every summer to Wisconsin. And I speak a lot to juvenile judges and librarians and school teachers about the impact of what I think of as the storytelling industrial complex upon young people, but also upon society broadly. And I've kind of coined a phrase that I call the sustainable imagination. And what I'm doing is sort of looking at a parallel between what happens externally in the way that we're in the world, and also what happens in this area we call the imagination. And I think we're so overstimulating the imagination by these very powerful technologies that now are the forms that we use for storytelling, whether that's, you know, movies, megachurches, Las Vegas, whatever. I mean, there's so much high stimulation in these forms that I think they have essentially exhausted the imagination in the same way that if you overstimulate the soil with fertilizers, you can exhaust the soil. So when we talk about political will, I think some of it is even deeper than that from my point of view. It's a lack of the imagination's ability to adapt to these tremendous changes and understand the consequences because the imaginations are exhausted, I think, really broadly.
Mm. That's a very interesting point. Naomi?
Yeah, that is an interesting point. I can't really say whether it's true or not, but I would say that the story we've written speaks to that in the sense that what we were trying to do in this book, in a sense, was to imagine a future and to say, look, this is what it looks like. And it doesn't actually take a gigantic amount of imagination. All you have to do is read the science and then translate that into what do these scientific results mean for people? What does it mean for the geography of the world if sea level rises 1 meter, 5 meters, 8 meters, 11 meters? What does it mean for agriculture if the temperature increases 2 degrees, 4 degrees, 6 degrees? And so the story we told is a leap of imagination, but only only just. It didn't take a lot of imagination to write a story about what this looks like.
Eric, what about our using our imaginative minds to envision what the world would be if we were not relying on fossil fuels? And we don't go that direction very often.
No, but of course that's part of the environmentalist imagination, right? The idea that we can have a functioning, fairly high energy economy with only renewable energies, that's certainly a leap of the imagination. And you know, the question for the scientific and engineering communities is, can they translate that imagination, that imaginary future, into a reality? Can you actually re-engineer the whole system to accomplish it? That's one of the things I actually find fascinating in studying that. Because you can see people working from, scientists and engineers working from the standpoint of that imagined future and trying to break it down into the little bitty nitty gritty of how can we make it all work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly a great leap of imagination that's fascinating.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe, so much for your call. Nate in North Freedom. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to mention something I've come across. It's called the petitionproject.org, and 31,000 some odd scientists have signed this petition, including 9,000-ish with PhDs, and the petition states that there is no convincing scientific evidence that human release of carbon dioxide, methane, or other greenhouse gases is causing or will in the foreseeable future cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere and disruption of the Earth's climate. Moreover, there is substantial scientific evidence that increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide produce many beneficial effects on the natural plant and animal environments of the Earth. And I simply wanted to state, 9,000 PhDs, these people have to be in the climatology, meteorology field. That's a lot.
Naomi?
Yes. There's a very simple answer to that comment, and the answer is that petition is a fraud. It's a fraud, and it's been exposed as a fraud. And, in fact, this is a really good example of how disinformation is spread, and it's extremely difficult to stop. Because even though that petition has been repeatedly exposed as a fraud, it still lives on the Internet, and people still read it, and people still think it's true. So just briefly, the original version of that petition was developed by Frederick Seitz, who is one of the people who wrote about at length in Merchants of Doubt. He wrote that petition in conjunction with his colleagues who he had worked with at the George C. Marshall Institute, a think tank which is not a scientific organization. And it was sufficiently egregious that the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, which is the most prestigious organization of scientists in America, actually issued a press release to disassociate themselves from it because it was, in fact, a fraud. The other thing that maybe the simplest way to know that this is a fraud is simply to say science doesn't work by petition. Petitions are political instruments, and they have a place in getting people on ballots for elections, but scientists don't work by petition. They work by publishing evidence and data in peer-reviewed journals and presenting it at conferences where scientists can review it, judge it, and make sense of it. If you want to know what the scientific community has to say about an issue, you won't find it in a petition. You'll find it in the peer-reviewed literature. You'll find it in the summary reports of prestigious groups like the National Academy of Sciences or the Royal Society or the French Academy of Sciences or any one of the 108 National Academies of Sciences around the world who have all affirmed the reality of climate change. So the petition is a fraud. And this is part of the challenge that we work with in this issue every day, is that this is an issue about which many people lie. And it's very difficult to talk about lying because it's an uncomfortable topic and because it's not considered polite to say that someone is lying. But the fact is many people have lied about climate change. They've done it knowingly, they've done it deliberately, and they've done it repeatedly for more than 20 years. That was the story we told in Merchants of Doubt. And we really hope that you and any other listener who is still uncertain about this issue will order a copy of Merchants of Doubt today and read it, because I think if you read our previous book, you will come to understand why these lies continue to exist, even though we know they're lies.
Daryl, Southwest Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, Daryl, go ahead.
We can't just talk about climate change. We have to get right into the what to do. solar is becoming very cost-effective, but our heating and air conditioning systems are only running 59% to 63% efficient. And we can educate the people and explain to them how to check their own systems and get these up to par, and then we can get on a par with Germany, because Germany is way ahead of us on solar, wind, and buildings becoming self-sustaining through renewable energy. All of this is possible, but we have to have broadcasting and other major mass communication media talking about it and explaining to people what to do and how to do it, and that's the only thing that'll work. We have to reach the masses.
Eric.
I can't speak in great detail to what Germany has accomplished lately. I can't follow too many countries at once. But I certainly agree that there's still a lot that can be done in the United States, from individual action to improving building codes for efficiency to produce buildings that consume less energy, and to figure out how to retrofit older buildings, because there's that ongoing problem of infrastructure. Once we build things, maintaining them and improving them becomes a challenge in and of itself. So I completely agree that there's lots of conversations we're not having about re-engineering our infrastructure for greater energy efficiency. In part, we're not having that conversation because we're still having this conversation about whether the science is valid, which distracts us from this larger problem of how do we solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's by intent. As long as we're still arguing over the science, we're not dealing with the probable solutions.
Immediate steps should have been taken, part of the book, to begin a transition to a zero net carbon world. And that should have started early in the 20th century. It's happened in a little tiny bit, but not on a huge scale. What immediate steps should have been taken, and were a little bit overdue for those steps now? Naomi?
Well, there are many things that could have been done, but the obvious one has to do with the Kyoto Protocol. The United States signed the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992, and President George H.W. Bush said when he signed it that we would take concrete steps to protect the planet and the people and plants and animals that live on it. But that never happened. It never happened because of political opposition that led to blocking the Kyoto Protocol, which was the addendum to the Framework Convention that was going to actually put teeth into the agreement, and those teeth were going to be binding emissions cuts. Because of political opposition, the United States refused to ratify Kyoto, and we never made those cuts that we had promised in the early 90s. So we're talking about 20 years ago that we knew what we needed to do. We said we were going to do it. We signed an international treaty, and then we didn't do it.
Let's go to Bob in Eau Claire. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thank you. Last Friday night, Jason Box, who is a climatologist and a glaciologist, was on Bill Maher's show, and he talked about the glaciers of Greenland and the work that they are doing documenting the decline of those glaciers. And he said something that was a revelation to me. And I don't think it's a revelation to you, because it sounds like it sort of supports what you are talking about. And that is that if the glaciers of Greenland continue to degrade and melt, and the Arctic ice pack melts and so forth and so on, we're not going to get a 6-foot water rise in our oceans, but we're going to get a 70-foot water rise in our oceans, which completely supports what you're talking about, which is that all of the cities that are adjacent to the oceans will be completely drowned, because a 70-foot water rise is a significant amount of water to deal with.
Naomi.
Yes, well, that's exactly right. And this is the key premise of our book, is the great collapse of our book is a double entendre. The first part of the collapse is the breakup of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which leads to dramatic sea level rise. And then the second part of the collapse, or the second meaning, is a kind of political and social collapse as institutional structures have to scramble to try to deal with the dislocation that occurs. Now, one thing that is important to say, lest people accuse us of exaggerating, which of course they will anyway, but no one is saying that 70 feet of sea level rise will happen tomorrow or even in the next few decades. The current scientific estimates for what will happen, you know, in the immediate future are still in the area of, say, you know, 1 to 6 feet by 2100. But there are a lot of scientists who think that's an underestimate because, as you just said, the evidence from Antarctica and Greenland is very disturbing. It shows that the ice loss appears to be accelerating. And many people think that even though the sea level rise may be manageable over the next 50 to 60 years, that if we continue business as usual, it then begins to go up into those figures, 10, 20, 30 feet or more, and that becomes truly unmanageable. And it's that idea of the unmanageability which is really the crux of our story, mm-hmm. that a lot of people somehow think, well, don't worry, we'll just manage whatever happens. 10 feet of sea level rise is not manageable, and 70 feet is a whole different world.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah.
Ray in Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, I'm somebody who owns a bike and does not have a car. I haven't ridden in an airplane for the last 14 years. Whenever I hear people discussing this topic, I always ask them, what are you doing yourself? For instance, the guest. Does the guest own a gas-powered vehicle? Does she fly around in airplanes every year to take a vacation? Mrs. Dunn, what are you doing? And don't say because I drive a Prius, I'm saving the environment. You know the damage caused by the manufacturer of the battery that runs in the Prius.
I couldn't afford a Prius, but I drive a car. I drive a car to work. I mean, we're probably not as pure as you are, Ray, but I think that people are trying to do certain things. What do you think?
Well, I'll answer that. It's a fair question. It's a totally fair question. So I want to answer in two ways. First of all, I just put 8 kilowatts of solar PV on my roof.
Good.
My family and I will be electricity independent for that, and we believe that we will generate enough electricity to power an electric car as well, although we haven't yet gone. We just did it. Like, it literally just got installed 2 weeks ago. So I don't yet know for sure what we're going to produce, but we're committed to being as electricity independent, renewable electricity as possible. Heating a house in New England without fossil fuels is a bit more of a challenge, looking into things like pelletized wood stove. So definitely I do worry about that, and I am looking at ways to reduce my personal carbon footprint. It's true that traveling around the world to talk about climate change is paradoxical, and I do worry about that. Sometimes I've bought carbon offsets. That's a complicated thing, too, but I'm certainly mindful of the issue. But the additional point that I think is really important to say is that we all live in a world that's structured in certain kinds of ways. And even if a person doesn't want to use a lot of fossil fuels, it's not that easy. Lots of people have jobs that they can't really bike to. It's not to say there aren't certain things they could do. All of us have some things we could do, but all of us are also in systems that are hard to change. And that's why, although personal responsibility is important, and I'm trying to do what I can, but it's also really important to talk about those larger systems. We can change our light bulbs by ourselves, but we can't change the electricity grid by ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to talk about both.
Yeah. Do you want to respond, Derek?
And what Naomi just said was my point about individual action is necessary but not sufficient. I can take the bus to work, and I do, but the fact is the bus is powered by natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
And until it becomes an electric bus and that electricity is coming from solar panels off in the Mojave Desert, I'm still contributing to the carbon problem. And there's nothing that I as an individual can do except work at my local level to lobby for a new or rather revised infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So individual action is necessary, but it's not sufficient.
Well, you both have provided a really interesting hour of radio, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, our pleasure. The authors of The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, our guests. This has been said about their book, which I think is a good description. The startling and all too plausible history of the century to come, in the spirit of George Orwell and Aldous Huxley and all the writers who have turned to prophecy in the attempt to ward off an oncoming disaster. We thank them for their time. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, you may remember, maybe a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, we spoke with Margaret Rosga about Freedom Summer and the trip she was taking with students to all kinds of places marking the civil rights movement in that summer in the South. She has returned. She will be with us along with the students and the editor of Risking Everything, a Freedom Summer Reader. That's coming up tomorrow. Thanks for listening.